Hello, and welcome to another tennis-worthy podcast brought to you by the International Tennis Hall of Fame. I'm Patrick McEnroe, and our theme for this month is independence. And in this show, we're going to recount one of the great independent stories of modern-day tennis. If you're a follower of tennis history, you'll probably have heard of the Original Nine, a group of women players who signed $1 contracts back in 1970 and became the first group of people to be inducted into the Hall of Fame in 2021. But what was the background? Why $1? Why was it such a risky move? And what role did it play in kickstarting women's professional tennis and making the women's players independent from the men who ran the game in 1970? My colleague, the tennis historian and regular tennis-worthy contributor, Chris Bowers, takes up the story.
For a revolution or a war of independence to happen, it requires two things: the right context and the right people. In the great battle for independence in 1970 that gave birth to modern-day women's tennis, there were two crucial people. One of them was Billie Jean King.
As a child in the 50s, it was difficult because I would play all sports with the boys, but I realized when I was 9 years old, when I went to a Pacific Coast League baseball game — this is before California had any major league teams — and I realized one day when I was nine that I looked around and I realized, because of my gender, that I can't play professional baseball. And I was so upset that day. I was really upset. I still get upset, actually, when I have to think about it. And not only, it's not just about me, it's just about all of us.
Alongside one of the two leading players in women's tennis was Gladys Heldman, the owner and publisher of World Tennis Magazine, which she had started as a community tennis initiative and built up over the previous 20 years.
It began in about 1949 as a one-page mimeograph sheet in Houston. We had moved there. My husband was elected president of the local Houston Tennis Association, which had a membership of 12. And I thought, to make his job more important, we ought to get more members. And that's why I had the monthly one-page mimeograph sheet announcing the turkey tournament for Thanksgiving and who was ranked 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 in the juniors at the local courts. And memberships were $1 a year for juniors and $3 for men and women.
As for the context, tennis, since its birth in 1874 as the sport we know today, had been traditionally an amateur pastime, which meant the most prestigious tournaments like Wimbledon, Forest Hills, Roland Garros, etc., were out of bounds for professionals. But by the 1960s, many of the players who played in those tournaments were being paid money under the table to remain amateur, while the unheralded best players in the world earned their living on the travelling professional circuits. In 1968, this weird split-circuit situation came to an end when tennis went open. But as Billie Jean King says, open tennis meant a lot more for the male players than the female players.
It really hit home in the first open Wimbledon, which means professional. That means we got money to play and win. And Rod Laver got a 2,000-pound check, and I got a 750-pound. So that's 37.5% of what the guys were getting. And my former husband, Larry King, he told me that when open tennis came about, if it did, that the men would try to get rid of us. They would think that every dime belonged to them. And I said, oh, no, they're my friends. I didn't agree with them. But Larry was totally right, and I was totally wrong. And so that was a huge awakening.
As early as 1968, King urged the U.S. Lawn Tennis Association to run a professional tour for women. But its all-male executive committee resolutely refused. And over the next couple of years, the discrepancy in prize money between men and women became greater. Matters reached a head in August 1970, when the women discovered that the prize money for the Pacific Southwest Championships, a tournament in Los Angeles run by the former Wimbledon and US champion turned professional promoter Jack Cramer the week after the US Open, was offering its male players around 10 times the prize money that it was offering its female players. So three leading women players, King, Rosie Casals and Nancy Ritchie, asked to have lunch with Gladys Heldman, at which they told her they wanted to boycott Cramer's tournament.
I said, well, before boycotting, let me talk to Jack and see if we can get a more equitable distribution of the prize money, or if he can get some more money for the women. I talked to Jack about a week later, and Jack took a very negative attitude. He said, if that's the way the women feel about it, I won't give them any prize money at all. And I said, well, Jack, think about it for a couple of days and let's talk again. A couple of days later, he said, no, I'm not going to give them any more money. And I said, well, then I've got a better solution. We don't want a boycott because there are some local women who could play as amateurs and some people who might be going on to Australia or whatever, and they might want to play your tournament. But why don't I do a tournament in Houston for 8 top women, and I'll have prize money. And he said, well, I could protest, but I won't.
So Heldman went ahead with preparations for her tournament in Houston, announcing that 8 players would take part. King, Casals and Ritchie were joined by 3 more Americans, Christy Pidgeon, Valerie Ziegenfuss and Peaches Bartkiewicz, and 2 leading Australians, Judy Dalton and Kerry Melville. 2 obvious missing names from that list were Margaret Court, who did the Grand Slam that year, and Heldman's own daughter, the top 10 player, Julie Heldman. Court initially showed some interest but ultimately declined to play, while Julie Heldman was injured. The 8 nominated players were labelled rebels, but to Nancy Ritchie, that was almost a badge of honour, given that her prize money from winning the first French Open had been withheld from her on instruction from the USLTA.
It was nice, especially after the not letting me accept prize money in 68, you know, at the French, winning it and having to, I mean, I guess I'm the only amateur in the women's to have won a Grand Slam title.
Despite Kramer's promise not to protest, the 8 female participants were notified by the USLTA that Houston was an unsanctioned tournament as it conflicted with Kramer's event, despite Houston being 2,500 kilometres from Los Angeles, and they were told that if they played in Houston, they would be suspended. Rosie Casals says the 9 women were up against the culture of the time.
I think we realized that this was a good moment to get our point across of the fact that the support that we should have been getting and certainly prize money that we expected to have with open tennis, we were not getting. So we realized that, you know, the game hasn't changed from that point of view. Men are still running the tournaments, promoting them, and very little women involved in all of that. So it was something that was difficult to maneuver because every time we needed to talk to somebody about women, it was a man. You know, it didn't matter. We'd go to the USTA. It's a male who you're talking to, and therefore, can they see your point of view? I would say not. Most of them did not because it was the times. You know, women didn't play sports. You know, 1972 didn't come into the picture for women's scholarships for sports and education. So, you know, we were ahead of the curve, really, in wanting to be equal in not just prize money, but recognition and exposure.
Until the first ball in Houston was struck, everything was still up in the air. The risk the participants were taking was considerable, as suspension would mean they could play no tournament tennis until the suspension was lifted. In fact, everyone who took part, including the Houston Racquet Club, all its members, the umpires, the ball kids, quite apart from the players, stood to be suspended indefinitely from all official tennis. It was a risk the players were willing to take for a brighter future, as Ritchie explained in an interview in 2021.
Suspended didn't really wasn't that big a deal because there was no place to play. I mean, there was no money. So it was worth taking the chance. I would rather throw myself in with Gladys Heldman, who was a success at everything she ever did, versus the USTA, who was doing nothing. And so there was nothing to lose as far as I was concerned. If it fell apart, well, okay. I mean, don't have anything anyway.
The week leading up to the Houston event was shrouded in doubt about whether the breakout tournament would actually go ahead. Amid this febrile atmosphere, Gladys Heldman made 2 moves that proved crucial. The first, an approach to Joe Kullman, the head of the tobacco giant Philip Morris. The second, the now infamous $1 contracts.
In the attempt to negotiate to get stature for our tournament to prevent the sanction, I said to Joe Kullman, may we call our tournament the Virginia Slims Invitation? That will give us at least a bit of muscle. He said, not only can you call it Virginia Slims, I will contribute $2,500 in prize money. So our prize money went shooting up by 50%. We suddenly had $7,500 for the eight women. An hour before the tournament was to start, we got nervous about the racket club and its members because they could be suspended. The deal that was offered to me by the sanctions committee of the USLTA was that we could hold the tournament if it were an amateur event and if the prize money were paid under the table. I thought it only fair to present this to the eight women players, which I did, and there was a great discussion. None of them wanted to take the money under the table. They were pros, but they were at that time a special kind of pro. If you were a contract pro, and there were no women contract pros in the U.S. at that time, you could play anywhere and you didn't require a sanction. Some of the men were contract pros. They'd signed to George McCall and they'd signed to Lamar Hunt. Lamar Hunt could play at any club and the club couldn't be suspended and he didn't have to have a sanction. So I said to the women players, let's protect the racket club and its members. You sign to me for 1 week for $1 and you'll be contract pros. So they agreed. I paid them each a dollar. We went out to announce this to the press. It was all taking place in 1 hour. The tournament was to begin in 5 minutes. A picture was taken of all of us, the women holding up their $1. And my daughter said to me as she received her dollar, does this mean I have to do the dishes?
The strongest image of the original nine was that photo taken at the Houston Racquet Club. Having signed the players up for $1 for a week's contract, Gladys Helbin summoned a group of photographers, handed out nine $1 bills to the players, and got them to pose for a team shot. But right up to the moment that historic photo was taken, efforts were still being made to try and avert a breakaway women's movement, as Billie Jean King recalls.
Just before we have that iconic photo, I'm around the corner talking to Alistair Martin, who is the president of the USLTA, pleading with him to do a tour one last time, but I also wanted to show him the courtesy of telling him what we're doing, because I didn't want him to read about it the next morning and not have any idea. And I thought that was the right thing to do. So I was talking to him, and he said, no, you can't do it. I said, well, you've left us no choice, so I want you to know when I'm hanging up, they're ready for me to sign this $1 contract with Gladys Helbin. He said, well, you're going to get suspended. I'm telling you not to do it. I said, but you've given us no choice. So I just wanted you to know. So I run around the corner. All the players are standing up. Julie Helman's not there. Gladys had talked to her about being part of the original nine. But they said, here's your space. Come back up here. It was in the back row. And I think Valerie Ziegenfuss or Nancy gave me my dollar. And I go like this. And the two camera guys were shooting away. And we're like, what are we doing? We're even kind of muttering under our breath like, oh, my God, we're actually going to try to do this. And that whole week, I kept calling Larry and saying, this is nice to have this tournament. But then what?
So the tournament went ahead as the Virginia Slims Invitational, with Billie Jean King and Julie Helbin playing the first point, the only point Helbin played that week. Despite her elbow injury, Gladys Helbin's daughter was not going to miss out on this moment of history, as she recalled in 2021.
The picture of the nine women was taken on September 23rd, 1970. Eight players and my mother, Gladys Helbin, the promoter. I wasn't in that photo because I wasn't planning to play. And it's been my major regret that I wasn't in that photo. I was not planning to play the tournament because I was injured. But when I heard that we were all under attack from the U.S. Tennis Association, from the men who were running tennis, I decided I had no choice but to come out in solidarity. So I played one point against Billie Jean. I lost it, of course. And we shook hands after that. Having played that one point, I showed that I was a member of the original nine.
Yet within 2 days of the first ball being struck, the USLTA had suspended all nine players. As Billie Jean King had said, it was nice to have the tournament, but then what? Despite the eight women being legal contract professionals and therefore having done nothing they could be sued for, they were suddenly faced with only being allowed to play the handful of fully open tournaments, which in theory included the four Grand Slams. But the Lawn Tennis Association of Australia banned its two rebels, Judy Dalton and Kerry Melville, for 6 months, which meant they missed the 1971 Australian Open. In addition, both were forbidden from using any equipment or clothing that was made in Australia, as Dalton recalls.
For Kerry, Melvin, Reed and I, it was quite difficult because we got a really hard time in Australia. We weren't allowed to play any tournaments, no Australian Open. We weren't allowed to use any Australian equipment. And I was very lucky because I knew Maureen Connolly then, because they didn't have texts or, remember, they had to telegram things. And she said, look, use my, because she had a racket with Wilson. So I used Wilson rackets and Wilson shoes and everything for a year, nearly 2 years, because we weren't allowed to use any Australian equipment or anything. And it was interesting because I did it, Kerry said, well, if Judy knows it's the right thing, I'm prepared to do it. But I can tell you her parents were not at all happy with me. They said, why are you doing it? And Kerry said, no, it's fine, don't worry. And, you know, and then when we had all the rocky bit, I thought, oh, I don't know whether her parents thought, you know, I really have done the wrong thing. But I think in the end they were quite proud of her, actually.
Gladys Heldman felt she had a responsibility towards the women she had signed up for 1 week. And with Joe Kullman having found the Houston tournament was a perfect marketing platform for Philip Morris's new cigarette aimed at women, the Virginia Slims, particularly as a ban on TV advertising of tobacco products had just come into force, there was suddenly a source of sponsorship money for women's tournaments, and a 21-tournament Virginia Slims circuit came into being. But it was not without growing pains. With two highly successful headstrong women leading the charge, there was inevitably the question of who would head the nascent women's pro tour, as Nancy Ritchie remembers.
After we had the picture, did the deal, Larry King arrived, and he and Billy tried to take the thing, and we had to have a meeting at Gladys's house and vote who was going to run the thing. Gladys thought she had it. I mean, we'd done the whole... And Larry comes in with this proposal, and we all were in Gladys's bedroom, and Larry, I guess, he presented his view of what the tour, how he was going to run it, and Julie came in and spoke for her mother and said, my mother's been a success at everything she's ever done, and Larry has been a flop at everything he's ever put his. And then we had to vote and had a little fishbowl thing. And we wrote out who, first we went into the other part of the house and kind of talked about it amongst ourselves. And I called Dad and asked him what, and he said Gladys. I knew that, but I couldn't believe what was happening. I couldn't believe it. I mean, here, Gladys had done all this. We voted for it, and in comes Larry trying to take it. And I mean, it was a thing that was just all mixed up. And I mean, no way. And so we voted. Peaches Barkowitz says, how are you going to vote? And I said, well, I'm voting for Gladys. She says, I am too. And so I know probably it was Kerry Melville, myself, Peaches, Val, Julie, of course, and it was Billy and Rosie over here on this. So, but Gladys won out the deal.
They all did manage to get along. Gladys Heldman running the tour for its first 2.5 years, with Larry King working with her, and another partner of a top player, Ann Jones's husband, Pip, as the tour's chief executive. The original nine, playing the Virginia Slims Invitational in Houston, marks the birth of the modern era of women's tennis. While the pre-1970 roles of female tennis pioneers like Lottie Dodd, Mae Sutton, Suzanne Longlen, Helen Wills, Maureen Connolly and others are unquestioned, 1970 marks the start of the self-respecting women's professional tennis era. As Billie Jean King acknowledges, it was very much in tune with the spirit of the times.
The 60s brought on a lot of change, and we were just a reflection of society. That's what was going on in tennis. You know, we were showing the way in a lot of ways. It was just very exciting times to see the growth of the sport at the grassroots level all the way up.
What 1970 was not was the start of the Women's Tennis Association, or WTA. That came 3 years later, just before Wimbledon in 1973, in what became a remarkable year for women's tennis. It was the year that King beat Bobby Riggs in the so-called Battle of the Sexes, but at that year's US Open, there was equal prize money for the men and the women. Just 3 years after the USTA had been thwarting the aspirations of the women players, it agreed to parity of prize money at its most prestigious tournament. That was testament to the efforts and charisma of King. Speaking in 1979, Gladys Heldman summed up why King was the perfect ambassador for the birth of women's tennis and how it helped her.
She had won Wimbledon either 3 or 4 times before, and nobody had ever heard of her. Now, with the women suspended, wherever we played, the newspapers gave incredible coverage, which they never had done before. And all the press wanted to interview Billie Jean King because she was clearly the number one. In the first tournament in San Francisco, she beat Ann Jones in the final, 6-1, 6-love. The following week in Long Beach, she beat Ann Jones in the final again, 6-love, 6-love. So Billie Jean was by far the most spectacular player. And when doing interviews with the press, they all wanted Billie Jean. They didn't want Anne. They didn't want Françoise. They wanted Billie Jean. And she was a marvelous spokesman. She came out very forthright in saying women's tennis deserves its place in the sun. And we are playing for what we believe in. And we don't care about these USLTA suspensions. The other problem was to get a tournament director who would work on it for 3, 4, or 5 months. And he would say, how can I ever get a women's tournament? Nobody will come. And I said, they will come because the press is following all these women now because they're constantly suspended. If the USLTA had not suspended them, if Jack Cramer had not screamed about women's tennis, if he had not put them down, women's tennis might have died. It lived because it came to a fighting climax and because Billie Jean and the other women, but mainly Billie Jean, was such a marvelous spokeswoman.
Gladys Heldman was inducted into the International Tennis Hall of Fame in 1979. King followed her in 1987, and in 2021, the original nine became the first group of players to be inducted, meaning King, Casals and Ritchie are Hall of Famers both as individuals and as part of a group. So how does King see her generation?
I call us the transition generation, to take tennis from amateurism to professionalism. And it's my generation and then the ones before that fought for it, particularly the men did with the Jack Cramer Tour and all that. But it's so important because it finally allowed us to make a living. The sport immediately went more global. We finally started to put ourselves on the map as a much bigger sport. More people got to watch it. More people started playing it. I mean, it's amazing what happened from the 70s. I got to go through what I call the glory years because I saw this tremendous growth that the players today don't probably know or appreciate, that I think I've just had such a much richer life because of it. I wish they would get a little bit more into the history sometimes, because the more you know about history, the more you know about yourself. And that's why the International Tennis Hall of Fame is so important. It's really saving the living history, not the past, the living history of our sport.
And yet the enormity of what the original nine achieved went well beyond tennis. How much one views it as part of the women's lib movement of the 60s and 70s is open to question. Not all the pioneering women players of the time see it quite so broadly. But there's no question they inspired people in other sports and walks of life. Here are 2 personal histories from the time. Judy Dalton telling a story from a golf trip to Scotland, and first, Julie Heldman's recollections from 1972.
On the second year of the Women's Pro Tour, we were still being housed. And housing because the money wasn't really big enough to support us traveling and staying in hotels. So in Oklahoma City, I was staying with a really nice young family. I arrived, we had dinner, we had breakfast the next morning. The man went off to work. The woman sat and talked with me. And she looked at me and said, you know, Julie, you're a free woman. Do you think I should get a divorce? And I realized she thought I was something bigger than what I was. We were a symbol of women who were free in ways that other women wanted to be free. So while I was not able to help her, it was a sign of what was to come.
We were playing golf in Scotland at the Renaissance Club, which is now where they play the Scottish Open Golf. And this girl behind the bar, she came over and said, was I Judy Dalton? And she said, I just want to thank you for what you've done. She said, I would never have been able to have had a professional scholarship. And she said, I would never have been able to play professional soccer. And she said, you don't realise what influence you all had in doing what you did to other sports, not just tennis, which was just wonderful to hear that. And hopefully they got the photograph, because I sent it to all of them and said, look, this is what you've done. This is just a fantastic effort. That really rang very true, that we don't know. We don't know what influence we had.
Amid the legend of the original nine, there's one detail of this story that's been largely overlooked. The Virginia Slims Invitational was a tennis tournament, yet hardly anyone talks about who won it. The answer is Rosie Casals, who was in fine form that American summer and beat Judy Dalton in a three-set final. But then, history shows that the nine competitors and the promoter Gladys Heldman were all winners, as were countless girls and women in all walks of life who followed them.
Chris Bowers telling the dramatic and moving story of how Billie Jean King and Gladys Heldman, plus supporting cast, broke free from the male-dominated tennis establishment to set women's tennis on the track to where it is today. The full interviews with King, Heldman, and members of the original nine are available in the International Tennis Hall of Fame's digital archive. For more in this series, go to tennisfame.com/podcast and choose from a wide selection of interviews and discussions involving the great names of tennis. I'm Patrick McEnroe. Thanks for listening to the Tennis Worthy podcast, and be sure to join us again in a couple of weeks.